Last week, we have 17 weeks on the book of Revelation. Usually we take a chapter at a time, and sometimes we can actually take two like we will next week. But this is number 9 of 17. So we're just about halfway through the book in terms of the number of weeks we're covering. We're a little bit further along in terms of the chapters. So just a real quick look back at last week. Last week was one of our longer sessions. We did a sort of a review of where we were and then plunged into one of the densest chapters of the book of Revelation. We were looking at chapter 13 in the identity of the beast, which in the book of Revelation, the beast, of course, the dragon is Satan, the devil, the sort of cosmic force of evil, and the incarnation of the of Satan or of the devil on the earth is simply called the beast. The identity of the beast was plain for anybody to see in John's world. It literally was right there in your pocket. So you would have the seven hills. You would have the woman who reclines on the seven hills or resides on the seven hills. And then you would have her identity, Roma. So multiple of the references in the book of Revelation point us over and over again to this coin and to this set of images. John also told us that the beast was a man, a human being. So sort of a dual here, that on the one hand, the beast is clearly Rome, the woman on the seven hills, but in another way, and again, John can shift back and forth. He's not linear in that sense. He can shift between metaphors back and forth. So the second metaphor is that it is a man, a human being, and that that man had a number, and that that number was 666, or in some of the ancient manuscripts, 616. But everything in Revelation, all those clues that we looked at last week, and we looked at a bunch of them, all go back to the same finger pointing. That the identity of the beast is not just Rome, but it's specifically one Roman emperor, and that is the Emperor Domitian. The Emperor Domitian is the emperor who's ruling the world at the time John is writing. He starts about 10 years before John is writing, goes to about 10 years after, so pretty solid that that's him. Domitian is also the only emperor that we know of who was widely believed by many people and multiple Roman authors we looked at, to be Nero returned from the dead. And the thought was that Nero was such a horrendous author, or such a horrendous Caesar, and that Domitian was such a horrendous Caesar that surely he was, you know, come back from the dead. Today we're going to look at chapter 14, and this is the announcement of what we would traditionally call the last judgment, or the coming judgment. Throughout the book of Revelation, John has said over and over again that God will ultimately step into history. God will act. God will make things right. There will be an accounting. And those who are evil will be punished. And those who are the saints of God will receive the reward. Tonight, we sort of in chapter 14, we don't have the account of it actually happening. We have the announcement of it happening. And it's so often true in the book of Revelation, John just puts layer after layer. So we have now the announcement sort of walking us through what will happen. And then next week, we'll actually look at the last judgment itself. We're also going to see a renewed call to remain faithful to God for just a little longer. Because if the last judgment is not yet, if there is, as John assured us last week, more suffering, a time, two times and a half, there's more to still to come, then God's people need to be patient. The judgment's coming. The reckoning is coming, but it's not quite yet. So we're going to see a call to remain faithful. We begin with a fantastic scene set in heaven. This is Revelation 14, opens with these first five verses. Then I looked, and there was a lamb. We've seen the lamb over and over again, the opening vision, the great vision of chapters 4 and 5. John repeatedly comes back to the lamb as a symbol for who Jesus is. I looked and there was a lamb standing on Mount Zion. Mount Zion, of course, would be the temple. So the lamb is standing in the temple, but there's something unusual going on here. And with him were 144,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, of course, that's the group that really identifies with this number, but 144,000 who have his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. So we've seen John use this symbol earlier as a way of that God claims his own, going back to the Exodus story and the marking of the door lintels. We use it at Ash Wednesday, the marking of the forehead. Basically, it's identity marker saying that we're claimed by God. And what God claims, God protects. And what God does not claim is bound for destruction. Then I heard what was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sing a new song before the throne, before the winged creatures, and before the elders. Now, John has just told us that we're in the temple, but now we have the throne and the four living creatures and before the elders. And we know from chapter 1 and from chapters 4 and 5 that this is not the earthly temple. We're back in heaven again. So this is the heavenly temple, not the one that was in Jerusalem. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. Little odd thing there. These follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They have been redeemed. This is the second time in this passage John uses imagery. Redeemed from the earth earlier, now redeemed from humankind, the first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth, no lie was found. They are blameless. Now, with 144,000, John begins to reintroduce several images that he's used earlier in the book. It's like a tapestry where you see a thread and the thread disappears underneath the fabric only to pop out again. This is one of these threads. The 144,000 were introduced in Revelation chapter 7. Now, there's a difference here between chapter 7 and chapter 14. In chapter 7, the 144,000 were people who were faithful to God, but who were still alive on the earth. It was just a reminder to John that you're not alone. There were a lot of people who remained faithful to God. So the 144,000 in chapter 7 are on earth. They're still alive. These were marked by the sign of Christ, John told us, so they would be spared in the coming destruction. So again, they're on earth. They're still living. We've been getting back in the earlier part of Revelation, these scenes of catastrophic destruction, and they were marked so they would be spared from that destruction on the earth. Here in chapter 14, there's a shift. It's not the same. All the imagery points now that we're not on earth any longer. We've shifted the scene to heaven, the four beasts, the elders, the throne of God. None of this would be physically on the earth. Mount Zion, then, is a euphemism for the temple in Jerusalem, the physical temple, but physically, the temple no longer exists. It was destroyed about 25 years before John is writing, and of course, it was destroyed in the year 70 by Rome. But for John, and for many in the Second Temple period, this is something we might not know automatically, the original temple, the true temple, the pure temple, still existed even after the physical temple had been destroyed. It existed in heaven. We get this imagery and this idea expressed very, very well in Hebrews chapter 8. They offered worship in the sanctuary, talking about the Jewish people worshiping in Jerusalem. That is a sketch and a shadow of the heavenly one. So for the author of Hebrews, the real temple was not the one in Jerusalem. That was just a shadow or a sketch. The real one was in heaven with God. We know, for example, that the Qumran community, the Essenes out there, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they have a famous scroll called the Songs of Sabbath Sacrifice, where it's the same thing. They're ignoring the temple in Jerusalem, and through their prayer time, their ecstatic prayer, they're taken up into heaven at the real temple. Now, this is actually based on an idea that goes back into the Torah, into the law. that deals with the tabernacle that Moses built, then of course the physical temple that Solomon built, where the things that were in the tabernacle were then moved into the temple. And again, the idea was merely a copy of the true tabernacle or the true temple. It goes back to Exodus 26. It's actually found five times in the book of Exodus. I'm just going to lift one up. This is God speaking to Moses. Set up the tabernacle, the place of worship, the place that will eventually become the temple, according to the plan shown to you on the mountain. So the idea was almost like, well, the real one exists, and Moses is shown the plan so Moses can make a copy of it, and of course Solomon can build a copy. So this idea actually comes out of Jewish tradition and is embraced within the Christian tradition. Later in chapter 14, John is going to repeatedly refer to the temple in heaven, because for John, this is the real one. The physical one, not only was it only a shadow and a copy, it's gone. But the real temple is still there where God is and where true worship takes place. That where in heaven is then reinforced by the statement that the saints who are now worshiping God have now been redeemed from the earth. So the true temple is in heaven, and these are saints who've been redeemed from the planet through death. This is a euphemism for dying, particularly for the martyrs. These martyrs are now in heaven, surrounded by angelic beings. So in Revelation 14, the 144,000 represent the vast number who have remained faithful to God and who have paid the ultimate price for that. They have given their lives for the faith. They have become martyrs. They are now in heaven, having been redeemed from the earth by God. These martyrs are the ones now singing the new song, not on earth as before. This song is now being sung before the throne of God. Now, a new song is another term that John brings back from chapter 5. There, the angels sing a new song to the Lamb. And if you remember in chapter 5, they sang the new song to the Lamb because the Lamb was slaughtered. And then we were told that by his blood, the saints were ransomed. So it's because of Christ's sacrifice for us that the new song is sung to him. Here in chapter 14, again, there is a shift. Those who have remained faithful, who have given their lives for the faith, join the angels in singing this new song. And then John hits us with a series of four images. First, they're blameless. Second, on their mouths, no lie is found. Third, they have not worshiped the beast. Fourth, they do not carry his mark. Repetition, repetition, repetition. All these metaphors say the exact same thing, just slightly shifting the verbiage. These have been faithful to God. They have not worshiped anything else. And then John shifts the imagery, as John often does, and says that these are virgins who have not defiled themselves with women. And you begin to wonder, well, what's John doing now? We're off on some sort of rabbit trail. But this is not about sexuality. John never addresses sexuality in the book of Revelation, except here with a metaphorical kind of image. John is using this metaphor to talk about something else that he is concerned about. He's not concerned whether people are virgins or not in the traditional sense. He is very concerned about whether or not they're virgins in another sense. Now, one of the clues we have is that St. Paul uses the same metaphor in the same way in 2 Corinthians. There he uses sexual purity as a metaphor for religious purity. 2 Corinthians 11:2. I feel a divine jealousy for you, he writes to Corinthians, for I promised you in marriage to one husband. Of course, that husband would be God. To present you as a chaste virgin to Christ, that you would have been faithful to God, faithful to Christ, not something else. Revelation and St. Paul both followed the much older Jewish tradition that comes out of the Old Testament prophets. The prophetic tradition, in that tradition, fornication and adultery are metaphors. They're metaphors for being unfaithful to God and to worshiping other gods. In these prophetic passages, Israel is depicted as the bride who is called to be faithful to God. But then the prophets, one after another, say that Israel was not faithful to God. She was an adulteress, or she played the whore, is the language you'll find. We see this, for example, in Hosea 4. As near as we can tell, it's likely Hosea who introduced this metaphor into the vocabulary of the prophets. My people consult a piece of wood, an idol, for a spirit of whoredom has led them astray. And they have played the whore, forsaking their God. So idolatry being expressed in sexual language. Same thing in Ezekiel. For they have committed adultery. With their idols, they have committed adultery. Now, for John, historically, there is only one woman that he's concerned about. We were looking at that last week, and we've seen it earlier again. You might argue that there's two, because earlier the woman was a symbol for the church and for Israel. She had the 12 stars in her crown, but this is the other woman that John deals with. This is the one that he calls repeatedly, particularly in chapter 17 that we'll get to 2 weeks, the great whore. 17, 1 and 2. Come, I will show you the judgment of the great whore who is seated on the many waters. Remember, the Roman Empire is around the Mediterranean Sea, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, like King Herod. And with the wine of whose fornication, the inhabitants of the earth have become drunk. Talking about idolatry, using sexual language to do that. Next, John is going to roll at us three angels. He's going to do this twice. We're going to have three angels now, a little interlude, and then we'll get three more angels. These three angels are announcing what God is about to do. Then I saw another angel. This is because there's been others before. This is the first of the three in this series, but there were there were previous angels. Then I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven. Mid-heaven. The lowest heaven is where the birds fly. The third heaven, or the highest heaven, is where God is. The mid-heaven is in between. It is the realm of divine beings other than God, with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth. So angelic beings with a gospel to proclaim to the earth, to every nation, every tribe, every language, every people, everybody. This angel said in a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, for the hour of his judgment has come. This is the last judgment. So announcing that things are shifting now, and worship him who made earth and heaven and sea and the springs of water. So the angel proclaims, fear God, give God glory, worship God, because the hour of judgment is nigh. Second angel. Then another angel, a second, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has made all nations drink of the wine of her wrath and of her fornication. Multiple metaphors, back to the sexual fornication, but also drinking the wine of wrath. Now, Babylon the Great, within Jewish tradition, is a coded reference. It's a symbolic name. It's not just the ancient city, because Babylon, the actual Babylon, the historical Babylon, was destroyed by the Persians in 540. So it's been gone roughly 600 years. Babylon was the city, though, that had destroyed Jerusalem and the temple back in 586, the first time it was destroyed. In later Jewish tradition, multiple sources tell us that Babylon then became a symbol for any later empire, any later city that became an enemy of God's people and God's people's faith, and then would persecute them for that. So any power out there that persecutes God's people becomes the Babylon of that generation. In the time John is writing, there is indeed another Babylon, another city. It is another city that, just like Babylon of old, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple. Now, John will repeatedly give us clues about this city. Back to chapter 17, just going to lift a little bit out here because we deal with this in 2 weeks. The great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Now, in the first century, there's only one, this is a short list, there's only one city that rules over the earth. He picks it up again in chapter 11. The great city, prophetically called Sodom, the place of evil, and Egypt, the place of captivity, where also their Lord was crucified. We looked at that earlier because Jesus is actually crucified in Jerusalem, but since Rome executed Jesus, you could argue that he was crucified, quote, in Rome with parentheses. And in 17, shifting back to the image of the woman, John adds these words, I will tell you the mystery of the woman, the whore. This calls for mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. So John has been sprinkling these hints, these clues as to the woman's identity all throughout. Fallen, fallen is Babylon. Here in chapter 14, John introduces the destruction of the beast. Not that it's happened, but it's an announcement that it's going to happen. But we see this in the prophets a lot. It's announced as if it has already happened. It's announced as an accomplished fact even before it's transpired. Now, John will repeatedly return to this, each time giving more color, more details. It's like overlays on top, one on top of another, just building that image. Now we get the third angel. Then another angel, a third, followed them, crying out with a loud voice, those who worship the beast and its image and receive the mark on their foreheads or on their hands, they will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured unmixed into the cup of anger. And the smoke of their torment will rise up forever and ever, and they will be tormented with fire and sulfur. In other words, not only will God destroy and punish the devil Satan and the Satan's minion on earth, Rome and Domitian, but even people who really give in to that force, they forswear their faith, they accept the mark of the beast. Those, and here for the first time, we get more explicit graphic detail of just horrendous things happening, as though those who are people of faith, who renounce their faith to give in to the pressure, it's just like there's a special place for them in hell, in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. There is no rest, day or night, for those who worship the beast and its image, and for anyone who receives the mark of its name. So John just drills down on this just intensely. Look at the three angels. The message of the first angel, fear God, worship God, there will be a reckoning. Second angel, Babylon, the great city, has actually fallen. You don't see it yet, but put it in the bank. Third, anybody who worships her will also fall, and their punishment will even be worse, and it will last forever. The wind of God's wrath. This is the ultimate motivational speech. In other words, the message here is don't even think about it. Do not think about worshiping the beast's image or receiving the mark. Even though there is immense pressure, as we know from records, from Roman records, immense pressure to do this. Instead of giving in, instead of compromising your faith, worshiping the beast so that you can buy and sell and participate in Roman society, there is an alternative for the people of God. John now turns to this alternative because this is the message he needs the people of God to hear as we wait for God's final acts. 14, 12, and 13. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, for those who keep God's commandments and hold fast to the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who from now on die in the Lord. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labors and their deeds will follow them. Call for endurance, for keeping the commandments of God, for holding fast to the faith of Jesus. Again, John hits us multiple metaphors with this drilling down on the same message over and over again. Now, keeping the commandments is an interesting thing. There were two tablets, as we know, of the commandments, and there were two sets of commandments. First had the commandments about our relationship with God. The second had commandments about our relationship with our neighbor. The key for John is the first tablet and the first three commandments. He never gets into the second tablet. Here are the commandments. Have no other gods. Don't worship idols. Do not bow down to or worship graven images. Clearly, this is where John wants to go. In short, as John has said over and over and over and over and over, do not worship anything other than God. This is the message that John will return to again and again. Hold fast to the faith of Jesus. Now, I want to look at this a little bit a second, because this is one of those deals where the Greek language and the English language differ. And when you translate from what John wrote in Greek to what we have in English, you can get tripped up real quick. We're told that what John says is hold fast to the faith of Jesus, but just know that the of is not there. It is pistis Iesu, faith, Jesus. The preposition is not there. You have to fill in the preposition. The same thing is true in four of Paul's writings where it's pistis Christu, faith of Christ. And so the question in those scriptures with Paul's letters is it faith in Christ or is it the faithfulness of Christ? Faith of Christ, Christ's faithfulness. Here again, just like with Paul, pretty clear, it's not Jesus's faith, in other words, what Jesus believed, it's his faithfulness, his obedience to God. That's the only issue in the book of Revelation. In Revelation, Jesus was first introduced to us as the faithful and true witness, Revelation chapter 1, the very beginning, verse 5. And just remember, the word that John uses to describe Jesus is the word that we translate as witness in modern Bibles is the word martyr, martes. In Revelation, Jesus' witness is that he died. That's how he witnessed to God. He role modeled what it meant to be faithful to God. As Paul will say in Philippians, obedient even unto death on a cross. He role modeled being a martyr. For John, the cross is not just a symbol for Jesus, it is the symbol for Christian discipleship. This is true in our own time, but with John, this is on steroids. It's the symbol. The cross is what it means to follow Jesus. Blessed are the dead, he says. That's true for Jesus who died for us. It's also true for those who have already died in the faith. And now John shifts it forward. Blessed are the dead who from here on die in the Lord. Knowing that more death to come. There are more deaths, pain, suffering, and those will also be blessed. Blessed is the death of Jesus. Blessed is the death of those who've died for the faith. Blessed is the death who still will die for the faith. Back in the letter to Smyrna, back in chapters 2 and 3, John urged believers to be faithful unto death. Sort of recapturing language about Jesus, he was obedient unto death. In chapter 12, John praised those who did not cling to life, even in the face of death. And then he added back there in chapter 12 that they conquered Satan, or that Satan was conquered by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And again, in Greek, the word testimony is martes, martyrdom. Satan was conquered by the blood of Jesus and by the blood of the martyrs, for they did not cling to life even in the face of death. John now adds, their mitzvah, their deeds, their good deeds will follow him. Now, by now you should know that John has no interest in ethics or moral behavior. That's simply off his radar. He's focused on one issue alone, faithfulness to God, even in the face of persecution, even in the face of death. Their deeds that he's referring to, these deeds of the martyrs, are not the traditional acts of social justice, but whether they stayed true to God, whether they surrendered their faith and capitulated and compromised, or whether they stayed true. And now we hear these words about the coming judgment. Then I looked, and there was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like the Son of Man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Now, John is once again turning to traditional Jewish imagery, imagery that is found throughout the Old Testament, but in particular in the book of Daniel. The Son of Man passage is almost lifted out word for word. I saw one like a human being. Alternate translation, I saw one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. And he came to the Ancient One, that would be Israel's God, and was presented before him. To him, to the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and kingship, that all peoples and nations and languages should, almost word for word, we read just a few minutes ago from the Gospel, from the book of Revelation. Now, this imagery became part of the Christian tradition even before John wrote Revelation. And the Son of Man came to be understood as Jesus. This is in all the Gospels, at least all the Synoptic Gospels, but here's Matthew's version. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all his angels with him, and we're just reading as though it was straight out of the book of Daniel, then he will sit on the throne of glory. Now John hits us with final three angels. Another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to the one who sat on the cloud, use your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. So the one who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. Second angel. Then another angel came out of the temple of heaven, still heavenly temple, and he too had a sharp sickle. Third angel. Then another angel came out from the altar. The angel had authority over fire, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, use your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for its grapes of wrath are ripe. Shifting metaphors again. John's always shifting metaphors. So the angel swung his sickle over the earth and gathered the vintage of the earth, and he threw it into a great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for a distance of about 200 miles. Hyperbolic language, very evocative. Now, John is once again in this imagery of the vines being harvested and the wrath of God, you know, squishing the grapes, blood coming out. Traditional imagery to talk about John's judgment. So the book of Joel, chapter 3. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Go in, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. The stage is now set. John has taken us again and again and again and again to the precipice of God's judgment. God's wrath has now been formally announced, not yet come. All we lack is the command for the execution. So next week, we are going to cover two chapters, 15 and 16, because it's there that the hammer falls and we have the bowls of wrath and the final seven plagues.